Hey, I'm Kevin, and I'm so happy to be here on a spring day. You guys happy it's spring? Anyone unhappy about that? Like feeling kind of down that it's spring? Well, we are actually, believe it or not, going to Edmonton, so it might appear that we feel like we're unhappy about it, but we're not. We're going to Edmonton for a week to visit some friends. But wherever you're at today, happy, sad, welcome here today, and bring that with you today as we enter into worship and discuss what God is doing. In the weeks before Lent and during Lent, during the season of Lent, we are talking about atonement. And we're doing this series called Toolbox Atonement. And the idea is that one theory of atonement isn't enough. So how many of you are really kind of up on atonement and talk about this all the time? There's a couple people here, and some of you might think, atonement? What are you talking about? What am I doing here? Am I in the right place or not? Well, I hope that you leave today and leave this series with a bit of a better understanding of what we mean by atonement. Atonement is how we talk about what God has done. It's about what the cross has done, and how we are brought into this harmonious relationship with God. I like to think of atonement as at-one-ment. That's an easy way to remember that it brings us at one with God. It makes us one. Atonement is the work that God has done through Jesus to bring us into healthy relationship with Him. So this whole thing might be new to you, but that's okay. There's not just one theory of atonement, not just one idea about what the death and resurrection of Jesus was all about and what it did. There are many different ideas of atonement, and many of them are very ancient. They go back to the very beginnings of the Christian church. I'm going to outline a few of the theories of atonement, and don't worry, we're not going to talk about all of them today. We're just going to talk about one of them. But here are some of the theories that we're going to cover today. Now, I think I just contradicted myself in the series. So the first one is Christus Victor. And the idea of Christus Victor is that through the cross, the death and resurrection of Jesus, God has won the victory over evil. He's the victor. He has won. The power of evil has been defeated. And because of that victory, we can live in victory now. And we can die and have the hope of life everlasting. And we know that because of this victory, there will be a new heaven and a new earth where sin and evil will be thrown down completely once and for all. The next one is ransom, and I had planned on talking about this today, but Heather did so well that I think I might just give you the summaries and call it a day. But that's the topic for today. I'll cover that in just a little bit. And then there's penal substitution, and although the name might not be familiar to you, probably the concept will be. This is the one that most people fall back to and use this type of language. It's really dominant in modern Christianity, and it maintains that Jesus suffered the penalty that was meant for us, that he took the consequences of the sin for us as our substitute. And there is also moral influence theory. And the atonement is viewed in moral influence theory as Jesus setting an example for us and how we ought to be as his followers. And it kind of goes like this. This might sound familiar. We ought to be like Jesus, who, being the very nature of God, gave up power, lived in humility, was obedient to God, and even died on a cross out of love for humanity. We need to imitate that. That's moral influence theory. So ransom theory is a metaphor of the early church. And I'm talking second or third century, so very early church. Probably that was the first Baptist church at that time. Not the Kelowna one, maybe a different one. John the Baptist founded First Baptist Church. How many know that I'm telling the truth, and how many think I'm making this up? I just need to know, because, okay, you're laughing. That's a good sign. I don't want to lead anyone astray. Some Baptists are kind of like that. But the idea is that Jesus came to give freedom, and he gave his life as a ransom for many. And I hope you can see that we need all of these images. We need many tools, which are metaphors, to talk about what has happened with the atonement, because one theory is not enough. The Bible is full of images of what's been accomplished. There is too much for one tool. And we need more than one theory of atonement, because the Bible has more than one image of atonement. And actually, even putting them all together, if we could put all of them together, they don't capture the fullness of what God has done, because it's beyond us to understand. So we need these metaphors and pictures. And all of these metaphors speak to something profound that has happened in the Jesus event, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. We need them all. We need all those tools. So today we're going to be looking at one of those tools. So the first week in the series, I talked about atonement in general, and I talked about penal substitution a little bit, and I said it was like the hammer in the toolbox. Last week, Steve had fun. A lot of fun. Thank you, Steve. That was fun. Saying that the tools he thought were sufficient, that maybe were the only tools he knew about, are WD-40 and duct tape, because they fix anything. So I had to think about that. The tools that most people know about, a hammer, duct tape, and WD-40, are taken up. What is left for me? Like, really, what is there left that anyone will know about? What am I to do? So I thought, for ransom theory, we're going to want a hacksaw. Isn't that what you want if you were behind bars? Yes. You'd want a hacksaw. And it might be a new one for you if you had to pick one of those three. So if you don't know what a hacksaw is, here's the picture. I'm sorry. That's actually, I don't know how that got in there. Let's go to the next slide. That's a hacksaw. And just like you wouldn't want to attack every job with a hammer, and you wouldn't want to use a hacksaw for every job. It would be great for cutting metal, maybe for some plumbing and things like that, but I wouldn't want to frame a house with a hacksaw. I wouldn't want to do electrical work with it. Imagine cutting the wires. It'd be kind of shockingly messy. And I certainly wouldn't want to fix my car with a hacksaw. We need the whole toolbox. Atonement's like that. The different theories are different tools to help us understand what God has done through Jesus. Just like you wouldn't show up at a job site with your toolbox with just a hammer in it, or just a hacksaw, or just one tool, we need many images and metaphors to talk about God, because he's so far beyond us. We need metaphors. One of the most memorable scenes from the, I hate to say it, old movie Braveheart. How many people here still think it's a new movie? The old movie Braveheart was when William Wallace, the Scottish rebel warrior, had been captured, was being tortured, and was just clinging to life. And the torturer had been giving him opportunities to confess his wrongs and confess the greatness of England, with the hope of a swift death. So the torturer thought he had finally brought William Wallace to the point where he had something to say. And so he said to the crowd, "Silence! The prisoner wants to say something." And the crowd hushes down. And by this time, he had been stretched by horses. He'd been disemboweled. And it takes a great effort for him just to remain conscious. So he takes this great breath. And to the shock of everyone, with his last breath, he yells, "Freedom!" Right? I love that scene. It's a famous line in that movie. But what could be more important and so important about freedom that he had to do that. Why was that so important? What could be so important about freedom that he was just driven and motivated with his whole being to hang on and through all of that torture and yell, freedom? What could be so important about freedom that he would use his last breath to proclaim it? This Lent season, we enter the spiritual disciplines, we share the sufferings of Jesus, we share the news of Jesus, and we declare what he has done through Lent, because Jesus proclaimed freedom. With his life, he proclaimed freedom. He proclaimed something that the early church was familiar with. His first day of ministry, he proclaimed what was called the Day of the Lord. Now, this is in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4, and it was at the beginning of ministry, and he quoted from the prophet Isaiah. And the prophet's words were well-known words, but he quoted these words in his mouth, applied to his work, applied to his ministry, to what he was doing. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim that captives will be released, that the blind will see, that the oppressed will be set free, and that the time of the Lord's favor has come. There's lots about freedom there, isn't there? With these words, Jesus makes a declaration. The time, the day, the era had come. The time of the Lord's favor had arrived. It is now, he says. A new era had begun. With these words, eternity moved into the present. And it was the good news. The day of the Lord has come. A time for freedom. With his ministry, he went about living and fulfilling that. He set captives free from bondage to sin. Like the woman at the well who was caught up in sexual sin and people wanted to put her to death. But Jesus stepped in and he declared forgiveness and freedom and told her to sin no more, that she was set free of the hold of sin on her life. He healed people. It was fulfillment and proclamation that the time of the Lord had come. It was good news, and it meant freedom. He went to the people who were on the margins, not the powerful church people. He spoke to the words of freedom to the people on the margins, words of liberation. He healed them. He befriended them. He ate with them. He walked with them. And he empowered them. And he declared freedom in word and deed. And then his time of trial came. What's traditionally known as the Passion, his suffering, his trial, his crucifixion. And he was consistent with his whole ministry, that even in his death, even in torture, he proclaimed freedom. The cross was a tool of sorts. It was a tool of terror and harm. It was a torture device that the Romans invented. It was a political tool because it was made so that the troublemakers could be displayed for all to see and learn that they could not stand up against the power of the Roman Empire. So they started using this execution tool that we now call the cross. And the Romans would place the crosses on highways and roads and busy intersections so that people could walk by and they could hurl insults and they could humiliate the people on the cross, all those troublemakers on the cross. This is how Jesus died. Not uniquely. Many were put to death on a cross. He, along with thousands of others, through the spans of the empire, was put to death on a cross, like a common political activist. And actually, if we were loyal Roman citizens And really, I don't think there's any reason to think that we wouldn't be, since we also live in the powerful West, as Rome was. We would probably have seen Jesus as a terrorist, as a threat to the state, one who threatened to unravel the security and fabric of the empire. So, like William Wallace, Jesus was tortured and put to death as an enemy of the state, as a terrorist. And there would have been little sympathy for him, just like there was little sympathy for bin Laden when he was caught and killed. That's the humiliation he endured. God, fully divine, yet fully human, came to love the world and proclaim freedom, and this was the way. It was irresistible grace and irresistible mercy, overcoming the ways of power and oppression through sacrificial and emptying love. Jesus died a terrible death, and he did so to proclaim freedom. And right to the end, he was resolute to proclaim that freedom with his last breath. Matthew 27:50 says, Jesus shouted again and released his spirit. Now, the gospel according to Matthew doesn't tell us what he said. It just says that he shouted. Maybe, like William Wallace, he shouted something that was stunning. Maybe he shouted something like freedom. It would make sense because his whole ministry and his actions and what he said declared this. But we do know that there was this cosmic effect with that shout. Something shifted. Something was broken. It carries on in Matthew in verse 51, Matthew 27:51. At that moment, the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, rocks split apart, and tombs opened. The bodies of many godly men and women who had died were raised from the dead. The gospel according to Mark also, Jesus, with his last breath, with a deep intake, because it would have been so hard to breathe, shouted. Mark 15:37. Then Jesus uttered another loud cry and breathed his last. Again, we don't know what he said. But maybe, like William Wallace, consistent with his ministry, he shouted, freedom. We do know that he proclaimed freedom in his whole ministry. We do know that there was this cosmic effect with that shout. Something shifted. Something was broken. This is what Mark said happened. And the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now Luke in his gospel, in Luke 23:46, is a little more specific. He puts words to the shout. With his last breath, Jesus shouted, Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands. His work on the cross was done. He had proclaimed freedom, provided freedom, and he was free. Now in John's gospel, we have a more muted Jesus, a quieter scene. We have him tasting, notably, on a hyssop branch, some sour wine. This is John 19:30. When Jesus had tasted it, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit, as if to say, my work is done. Whatever version you look at, whether Jesus says no words or says different words according to each writer's theological agenda and point, one point cannot be avoided and is consistent in all. Jesus did something. Jesus accomplished something. Jesus proclaimed freedom. Did you know that Jesus' death on the cross is closely related to the events of the Passover? Passover is the most celebrated Jewish holiday. And the very identity of the Jewish people to this day is connected to the events of the Exodus from Egypt. And they are a people whose identity is forged by belief in a God, by worshiping a God who delivers people from bondage, who breaks them out of slavery and brings freedom. You know that the Israelites really thrived in Egypt? It was really bothersome to the latest Pharaoh that they were thriving. They were slaves, but they were doing well. And he came to power and he said, this has to end. So he treated them poorly, gave them hard labor. But then there was this baby that came along, born to bring them freedom. His name was Moses. Moses grew up in Pharaoh's palace, but God tells him he is the one who is going to lead his people out of slavery. He will be the leader. He complains. He kvetches, as the Jews would say. It's a good Jewish word to kvetch. If someone's complaining to you, just say, stop kvetching, and you'll look either smart or dumb. I don't know which, but it'll be interesting. But he does. He kvetches. He complains. And God gives him power. And he has some terrible tools to convince the Pharaoh to release his people. There are plagues, a series of plagues, but the last one is different. It's a plague of death to the firstborn in the land. And it's one that requires a sacrifice. It requires a sacrificial lamb. And a lamb is to be taken by each family or combination of families, depending on how big the family is, and the lamb is to be slain. And all the lambs are to be slaughtered at the same time at twilight. So the whole community in Egypt slaughters them together at twilight. And they take the blood of the lamb and paint the threshold of the door using a branch of hyssop. Remember in the Gospel of John, when the sour wine was given to him, it was hyssop. We can't miss that. And that sacrificed lamb, the blood shed, protects the inhabitants of the home. And then the lamb is to be roasted and eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And it's got to be eaten in haste, like you're going to go on a journey. And none of it is to remain in the morning. You've got to eat all of it. So you've either got to have a lot of guests or really like lamb, because it's got to be all gone. So make sure you have enough people at your house for Passover, or you're going to be sick. So they eat this lamb. And that lamb gave them freedom. The lamb led to freedom. That lamb was a ransom for slavery. Passover is a celebration of birth and rebirth and this journey of slavery to freedom. And Jesus is the lamb. You know, with ransom theory, we know that we are passed over like the Israelites were. And because of this, we get to go free. Jesus was with his disciples at the Last Supper. And Jews had come from all over the place for Passover, because the Passover lambs were all being driven into the city at this time. And as we've seen at Passover, they eat the lamb, all of it. And what did Jesus ask us to do? In mimicry of the Passover, we eat the lamb, his flesh and blood, as a metaphor for his sacrifice. And today we call it communion. The death of Jesus at Passover season is hugely significant and not an accident. Paul calls Christ our Passover. And just in case we miss the parallels, the command not to break a bone of the Passover lamb for Jewish Passover is applied by John to the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, that not a bone of his body was broken. Jesus offered himself as a ransom to bring freedom. And at its heart, the ransom theory maintains that Jesus came to set captives free and to proclaim freedom. And when we think about the ransom theory of atonement, one of the more important words, theological concepts, life principles that we can think about is freedom. If nothing else, the ransom theory of atonement is about freedom. One day the disciples were talking to Jesus about the kingdom, about its establishment, and how it would be brought in. When will you unleash your power, Jesus? When will you smash the Romans? Can we rule with you? Can I sit on the throne beside you? And Jesus revealed to them that true freedom isn't offered with power, but with weakness, with sacrificial love, with overwhelming force of love, with being a servant. And his mission wasn't to make the enemy pay, it was to pay. Mark 10:45 says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Jesus paid the ransom price to obtain freedom for us. And it's a powerful metaphor, isn't it? You ever been in bondage? You ever needed rescuing? Ever felt trapped in sin? Ever felt trapped in patterns? Jesus came to give freedom to that. And it's no wonder that they picked up on this metaphor. And it's no wonder that the biblical writers use this metaphor, because it's part of the story of Israel. And we even today sing of in their Christmas carols. Remember this one? O come, Emmanuel, to ransom captive Israel. This theory of atonement is thoroughly scriptural, and it's in our history. So, we need to pull out that hacksaw, right? Because Jesus cut those bars and broke us out of captivity and set us free. And I want to ask you a question. Where do you need freedom? Because all of us, like the Israelites, like the woman at the well, like the lepers, even like those Scottish rebels, need freedom. Where does the word freedom speak to you today? Let me ask it in a different way. What does that hacksaw need to break? What does that hacksaw need to cut free? Jesus came as a ransom to offer freedom. He came to offer freedom from and freedom to. Freedom from captivity. It could be a lot of things. It could be from the past, from hurts, from mistakes. It could be from the present, being trapped in sin. It could be from the future, trapped in fear of the future. And Jesus speaks freedom to that. He offers freedom. He was ransomed so we could be free. But it's not just freedom from, it's freedom to. It's freedom towards something good. It's not freedom towards a life of misery and rules and regulations. It's a freedom towards a life of abundance and health and wholeness. It's freedom towards living the promised future of eternity today. It's freedom towards healed relationships with people in your life, with friends, with families. It's freedom towards healed relationships with your neighbors, near and far. And it's even freedom towards healed relationships with the earth, with God's creation, celebrating it, respecting it, stewarding it. And when does that freedom start? By God's grace, it starts now. We don't want to wait till we die. That's not the way of the gospel or the way of freedom. We are ransomed and freed now. And Jesus calls us to be his people now, to be a people of freedom, to be a church of freedom. You guys want to be a church of freedom or captivity? Quick poll. Freedom. Yeah, that sounds better, right? To be a people who live in freedom, who proclaim freedom, and demonstrate freedom. That's our mission. That's our calling. But that's also our identity and our being. We are freedom. With his life, up to his very last breath, Jesus proclaimed freedom. And we need to take a deep breath, hold it in, and breathe out freedom. You ready? Freedom! Can you do a Scottish accent when you say freedom? I don't know. Freedom when? Freedom starts now. Amen. Let's go and make it so.